these token credit cards you see, to my knowledge, there actually is almost, you have two accounts on the card. One is, there is a crypto amount, and then there is a local currency account, and you just transfer forward back. It's a bit like a cash voucher you get from the commerce side. So in that sense, I think, let's see how this plays out. But no, I don't think anybody really knows how this is going.
You're listening to Commerce Talk with Smart OSC. Welcome to Commerce Talk with Smart OSC. I'm your host, Adrian Wakeham, Regional Manager for Australia and New Zealand at Smart OSC. In today's episode, we wanted to gaze into our crystal balls and beyond by having a look at what could very well be the future of commerce. We're going to explore what emerging technologies like cryptocurrency and the metaverse have in store for commerce and how companies can build a future-ready culture. Now, to help guide us on this journey into tomorrow, we've brought aboard one of the brightest forward-thinking technology strategists in Southeast Asia, Axel Winter. Axel has a long track record of bringing business operations into the future, so we figured who better to talk to on this particular topic than Axel. So welcome to Commerce Talk. Axel, please tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you've been doing.
Well, thanks a lot for having me, first of all. And again, double thanks for the great introduction. So again, quite impressive, more impressive than it actually is. What I'm doing actually is very simple, right? I just deliver technology. It's as simple as that, right? It goes down to the basic. It's not about boardrooms. It's not about PowerPoints. It's really about, let's break it down. Let's focus on the tech at hand and try out cool things. And when you start them, sometimes people kind of, the naysayer club, can't work, it will never work, have been tried, forget it, right? And then sometimes these things do work and they do catch on. Who would have thought Chat and Shop ever is actually something which is people are interested in? And now we're seeing it's part of Asian commerce, and we're seeing this type of, let's say, conversational commerce also booming in other continents. So my background is really being a techie since day one, helping to build the internet, working with companies like Netscape and internet service providers in university in Germany, and then later when I came to Thailand in 1992 to do it here, right, in the region. Actually helped building the internet in Thailand, in Indonesia, in Myanmar, in Laos. And because even in these countries, they didn't know what it was. Then also there was no browser, to be fair. It was email, and if somebody remembers Gopher and links and so on, people didn't know what it was. So there wasn't even the idea of from the government to check it out, right? So it was just people just doing it type of thing, right? And then from there, I had my own company at the time, and then so startup, tech startup, you would say now, if there would have been a VC around, would have been nice at the time. I had a corporate partner, and at some point that went more in the traditional IT, helping the partner to do her own IT. And I moved to Accenture and then stayed there for 8 years. Again, doing a lot of e-commerce. Again, now we would probably talk about digital commerce or digital platforms across different industries, government, airlines, Singapore Air comes to mind, different government entities. Healthcare, banking, of course, commerce also, all sorts of things, as you can imagine, right? And across Asia, Europe, a little bit in the US. After that, what did I do after? I went to GE Capital, again, now just being broken up into its final set of 1,000 pieces, sad story. And maybe we can, when we get into culture and approach, we can talk a bit about that, why that happened. But anyway, it was an exciting journey. Biggest credit card issuer in the world at the time, 500 million customers, if you can imagine it. Very fortunate to work with some super talented architects and engineers from the US and from Budapest, and then build a global platform for these 500 million customers. Then I went to Deloitte and Cisco CTO at Cisco, and Standard Chartered Bank for a longer time, being the global chief architect and head of IT strategy there. also exciting to get a bit traditional organization, but with capability, with good intent into the future and having super ability to try things out. My boss, the CEO, he was always very, okay, so don't annoy me, take the money and go type of thing. And so we built fantastic things. The bank today still leverages. Then I went to Central Group, starting up a tech team there, digital team there. I think in the end it was around 450 people or so, and doing fantastic things. And then now again being with CMP Rod and driving kind of a new digital engagement platform. That's kind of the story.
Wow, thanks for that, Axel. That is one of the most impressive resumes I think I've ever heard. I've ever heard everywhere.
And
I guess the beauty of that is, you know, you've been at the bleeding edge of technology development the whole way through as you're sort of moving through there. So I guess that's a perfect way to kick off straight into let's look at what the future holds.
Yeah, but you know, just to chime in there, right? You know, I'm going to be a pain in the podcast, right? You know that by now. I just got to keep interrupting you. No, but seriously, I think it's also choice, right? I always fascinated about new things. I looked at them and I tried them out myself, maybe with the team, if that, depending also on the topic, of course. And then, hey, what can you do with that technology? What's the application? I say, what's the business use case? You know, how can we evolve that? And that's exciting, right? I was also very lucky, had the opportunity to try out new things. I remember 2012, I looked at Hadoop. Hadoop 2 was just released. I know CBS did look at Hadoop 1 even, but there were not many, I can tell you that, who looked at this kind of what then later became big data and now is cloud kind of data, AI platforms. Not many people looked at it. And again, as a team, I was the first, but then as a team at the bank, we did quite a bit of that. And suddenly Sunchart is one of the top players worldwide on data and being data enabled, data insights, AI and so on. So just say is that some of these things can be small flowers and they seem unimportant. But if you have a passion for these things, which is critically important, of course, then you can deep dive and try them out. And then, you know, nurture your flowers and babies and so on. And then suddenly they become big and they create a new wave.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, and I guess the beauty of it in particular for someone with your background, Axel, is, you know, you're talking about how do we find the practical human applications of the technology? It's not using technology for technology's sake. And you mentioned before, you know, like voice commerce, for example, there's been a way that people have identified voice commerce. It's all, you know, it's all Google Home devices and Amazon Alexa and that sort of thing. But then you flip at it and there was a photograph I saw a couple of years ago, which was actually a gentleman sitting on the steps of a train in India talking into his phone. And the context behind it is this is the real value of AI and of AI and voice commerce, because you're opening up all these digital pathways to people that potentially don't know how to read, but they know how to talk. And, you know, so this now opens up the capabilities of what the internet and all of these digital applications can do, where you don't necessarily know how to type the words into a keyboard.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah. How do you know until you try? I it's sometimes so sad to see that many organizations just thinking about this as a copy and paste job. Okay, everybody does A, everybody does this. It's like a linear, I call this kind of a linear progression of technology. You see it somewhere, you copy it because it's what people do, and then you copy the next thing and so on, right? And that doesn't have to be bad, of course, right? I mean, it's a choice, but it seems If you do a job and you have passion for it, for me it seems a funny thing that you wouldn't want to think this through and improve and you know, go a bit crazy every now and then, right? Now, not to the degree that you become an academic and you create a PhD study of what you could do taking years and not executing, of course, right? That you need to be sure that you have a fair mix of fast execution. But also, again, innovating and creating. And I feel that many organizations have forgotten that And that's why we are actually thinking about or talking about digital transformation, because people just forget. They just don't do that, right? And they don't change. They don't adapt. They do what they read in the news a bit here and there. But at some point, that's not going to work for your business. So again, you have a hyper transformation. And then you do that. But actually the fundament is really the mindset change of trying things out, engaging, creating organizations which can deliver fast.
Yeah, and look, and I definitely want to circle back to that, because I think we definitely want to try and touch into culture, you know, into business culture in a little bit later. If I can, I guess, sort of move into talking a little bit about, you know, some of these new business models that are out there. By now, you know, we've all seen Mark Zuckerberg, you know, formerly of Facebook or now Meta, you know, and that virtual home that he built inside the metaverse, or at least what he imagined it's going to look like, complete with that very conspicuously placed bottle of Sweet Baby Ray's barbecue sauce. How would you decorate your home in the metaverse? I mean, is it something where you have a lot of classic Da Vinci artwork on the walls, or go something more modern? Or,
well, I'm beyond homes already, right? Talking about my own planet now. I mean, why start with walls if you can do whatever you want? You know, I don't know. I think more about mix of island and mountains and good temperatures. Hey, I'm living in Southeast Asia, right, in Thailand. So that's more like it, and stay and sleep where you are, and then create instantly things if you so desire them, right? Like, I don't know, Paris downtown coffee shop or something, San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge view for another second or something. That's more like it, what I'm thinking. How about yourself?
I won't profess to really understanding a lot of art, so I'd probably dispense with the art entirely and make sure that I could create my own universe, planet, whatever it is, and just surround myself with all of these amazing vintage musical instruments that I have no idea how to play, but would just like to be able to have around and invite people who can play music really, really well to come around and jam. And I guess where we're talking about, you know, obviously the metaverse is starting to become, you know, a lot more talked about. Have you got any predictions for sort of where you're seeing that potentially would play across into the worlds of commerce?
I think this is a difficult question, because if I go by, let's say, what Mark's view is, then it's using normal glasses, and you kind of are, just by the merit of having a special glass, being immersed in the metaverse, right? And now these glasses don't exist today, and I still struggle a little bit with understanding how they work, because I do have an Oculus 2 set, but when I wear it, of course, the idea is it blacks out all the vision the eye has, and you can just see these two small monitors in front of you, right? And this blacking out thing is, and having this clunky thing in front of you, again, why it offers opportunity and excitement, like a lot of people obviously use it for gaming and so on. But on the other side, is it a mass, everybody has a type, like a mobile phone type of thing? Not sure. I think that this is where the glass idea comes in. So I think there has to be some more R&D there to create a better entry point, to be put that way. Now, if I go back in history, you know, my hometown is Hannover, which happens to be the city where, and it doesn't even exist anymore, it's the biggest IT show in the world. CeBIT, it was called CeBIT. It existed for, I think, 20, 25 years. So I met people like Jack Tramiel, Steve was there, and I mean, again, earlier days, it was kind of, I remember when they launched Next, I remember when Atari was big in the home computer space and so on. So all of these times, right? And then, because my hometown is not that big, it's about 500,000 people, then you kind of know where people would be going in the evening, so you can meet all of these guys and girls, of course, right? And to that degree, SGI, Silicon Graphics, also used to have every year a stand. I remember it was fascinating. So we were, I mean, I was like 17 or 16 or something, and we would queue up at their stand and trying to get an opportunity to use the headset, which actually would allow you to watch a bit of a 3D environment, and you get a glove and you can touch things and so on. And of course, they had a whole mainframe there at the stand. and the headset was connected to a very heavy pair of cables, and so was the glove. So there was some effort there. Now, from that perspective, we moved to the Oculus quite a bit, but of course, I don't have to have the mainframe next to me anymore. But on the other side, I still have a clunky headset. So this is what I meant, is that I'm thinking is that people have been trying this for a very long time, as in the full immersive VR type of environment, not yet. Now, the other part which Mark kind of said was the overall integration across corporate borders, right? So you could have a standard, like, more or less like our APIs and even some UI standard exists today for mobile and web browser usage, and mostly mobile anyway nowadays. And then, okay, you could do that in a metaverse as well, that you find kind of common standards for all of these things. But is it like, because now I'm hearing Microsoft is going to do their own thing. Facebook is obviously becoming an infrastructure provider, moving a bit out of the Facebook's, you know, social media type of game in that sense, getting rid of all of their problems there. So again, just providing the platform. And who knows what Google and Amazon and others are going to do, and new entrants. And there are some obviously also in Thailand and the region. And so for me, this is already doubtful that can you create really such a standard in today's world? Because it's not like the internet when we started it. I mean, the founders generation, so to speak. I mean, that was everybody wanted to work together. A lot of the people there were from universities to begin with or government institutions. And they loved doing standards and linking up with each other, right? That was kind of, it was new, it was exciting. Nobody could link up anything, right, at the time. And so that was all good, right? But today, I think there's a lot of people who also see this more as a, well, if I create the island, isn't that much better than if I'm part of a city type of attitude, right? Now, if that is going to go down that path, I also don't know. And then how would it work? Again, I'm just a simple tech guy, right? So I think about this very pragmatically. Now, assuming Mark is correct and there is a common platform which every company subscribes to or not, then I think we do advance. If I can use Facebook Messenger, let's say, or VR Messenger in the future, and whatever product from Zoom and Google and so on, and Microsoft, in a similar way, I can just tap and pull things together, capture people. Actually, how I communicate doesn't matter anymore. I just ping you and others, and we can have kind of a virtual meeting there. Who cares who provides the software? Well, that'll be cool. I'm just not too sure how far this goes. Now, what happens today, though, is there is an on-ramp where people, of course, are engaging in avatars and trying smaller worlds, smaller interactions out. And I think that's good, because that's the way we start defining and refining how this space in the future is going to look like. Some of these is going to go away, of course, as you can imagine, and others are going to become bigger over time because consumers and people love it. So for me, this is good, but it's too early to say actually where is the value, how business models could be easily established in that. I think that will take time. And if the past kind of taught us anything, is that it's neither black or white. It'll evolve into a mesh of things.
Commerce of any description can't exist without payments. So, you know, I mean, are you seeing, you know, digital banking, open banking, whatever sticker you want to put on it, you're seeing, is that the way forward for both consumers and businesses, or you're thinking, you know, or a cryptocurrency is potentially going to be the future for payments, whether we're talking the metaverse or anywhere else?
Yeah, this is actually, it seems like an easy division, but actually it becomes a complex question. I think the first thing is that today already we see the digital payments are the online are the far majority, even offline. Across, I think Thailand is around 20% offline, as in store and restaurants and so on. They're already 20% digital payments altogether. My guess is actually it's more, but it's tricky to recognize all transactions easily. So if it's a credit card, is it a digital credit, online only credit card? Is it prompt pay, or did you pay with your debit card? It's not always so simple to get the numbers correct for statisticians. And so I'm thinking is that there is already, so you already actually have. Now the question is, how is this payment space evolving, right? Today, even though there are many digital wallets, what we see is that in Thailand, PromptPay, and again in Singapore Pay Now and so on, they seem to be taking the lead because it's a common standard, right? So, and that makes it much easier for everyone to interact. Not saying digital wallets could not work. I know True Money in Thailand, for example, very successful. Also, Dolphin being another very successful wallet in Thailand. And I'm sure there are more, which, again, goes a bit too far. Now, what's the next step for these? Well, the thing with tokenization is, or let's say crypto currencies, is the governments themselves, the regulators, they will want to have a digital currency at some point, right? So, but however, that is literally because also you need to control the amount of in order to manage the economy, you need to control the amount of money which is in circulation and so on, right? So the government has a vested interest not to have, let's say, Bitcoin becoming a global currency, because then who is going to manage the money supply and help the quantitative easing and all of this, which we are seeing in every crisis in the media, that banks keep printing more money. Of course, nobody prints anything anymore. This is just someone goes in the computer and then expands the money supply, and it's anyway managed by throughout the banking technology platform end to end, right? The least amount of money actually is being printed. So in that sense, you have that. Why is that? The side effect of that is that the current payment system, which we predominantly use, Visa, Master, debit, checks, and whatever there is, and that is actually from the late 50s. So meaning is, we are more or less really haven't changed payments altogether. Now, of course, we have WeChat, WePay Now, and Alipay, which is very successful in China, but it hasn't jumped out of China as much. And China was in a certain way. There were only two very strong companies who divided the market in a sense. But in all the other countries, we have so many players now. So it's also not easy to drive the standard, and that's why some of the government efforts have been more successful, again, at least in Asia, because of that. Now, that being said, is there are parallel of what the regulators are doing, there, of course, are cryptocurrencies, and there are also loyalty points and things in between. Asset-backed tokens, there is a startup called Lyka, L-Y-K-A. Basically, they have tokens backed by diamonds, and you can use them to buy, as I believe, e-commerce stuff. It's like an e-commerce marketplace using diamond-backed tokens. So they're out of the Philippines, and I think they expanded to Hong Kong, and they are further expanding into the region. Ryan Bate is CEO. So good story. And I can think that there will be more of that. But at some point, when the amount becomes meaningfully big, what would the regulator then think, right? If they cannot control the money supply, because now all of these are packed again into a local currency. Even these credit cards, these token credit cards you see, crypto credit cards, to my knowledge, all cases I have seen at least, there actually is almost, you have two accounts on the card. One is there is a crypto amount, and then there is a local currency account, and you just transfer forward back. It's a bit like a cash voucher you get from the commerce side. So in that sense, I think let's see how this plays out. But I don't think anybody really knows how this is going to work. What we see is in the investment space, the movement away from traditional investments like property investments like REITs, and others into token-backed investments or crypto investments is significant, so significant that the big banks also moving into the space. We are seeing in Thailand, CM Commercial Bank, of course, having acquired, I think, more than 50% of Bitcup. And then I know Kasikorn Bank is working, has this announcement in Cubix. And of course, there are others. And we have individual players like Sipex, which, to my knowledge, Bank of Ayutthaya, which is part of Mitsubishi Bank, has shares in, and so on. So you see that all the banks are definitely interested in extending this, and also there are a lot of becoming sizable players in this space. And some of these, like Sipmex, and for example, they're using this again to enter into the merchant services, tenant services, commerce services type of environment, exchanging with other loyalty platforms and service providers, vouchers and all this, right? So you see that this is going to increase for a while, getting probably more rather than less. And then the question is, if some of these create a lot of value for consumers, they're going to get bigger. And then in the long term, we need to see what the opinion of the regional regulators is. But Asia, be in mind that Asia, in terms of retail startup investment, is globally the number one region, double of Europe. Just this quarter was, Q3 was 423 deals, just in that quarter, 11 billion. Of investments dollar. So I think it's fair to say that tokenization one end and also, let's say, innovation in retail and the combination of both, we probably see it first in Asia before anywhere else.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, look, you know, I guess that's kind of a good segue into the next subject I was going to ask you about, Axel, which is shifting gears a little bit. You know, as far as business in general preparing for the future, you're on record a lot over recent times writing about actually creating a startup within a larger corporate environment. Can you talk a little bit about how you've identified having a startup within a corporation actually helps to future-proof that larger organization for the future?
Yes, actually it's an excellent question. You know, the way though is there are many ways you could try. It does not mean that this is the only way. But again, as you said, I also tried out a couple of different options. As in, can we change an existing organization as is? Or can we open a new entity within a conglomerate, like a new team, and give it different rules and so on? So which one would work better? And I would say is, again, having tried especially at larger companies, having tried both, I would have said is for large corporate, I would definitely say that the internal startup and then owning some of the digital things is an easier way. Why? Because you have a number of factors. So it starts with recruitment. It starts with salaries. It starts with job titles and, you know, finance, even finance processes and procedures, right? Budgeting. How, you know, all of these things, even so we're not even talking about the content, the innovation itself, even these things now, culture in all the organization, because many people have been there and rightly so, because they're doing a good job for a long time. But again, if you then hire a totally new team, a tech team, of people who know what NFTs is and how to implement them, then of course they may not fit so well together at all times, right? So you need to think about a model to enable these different ideas and staff and also working methodologies, as in agile, sprint, and so on. You need to enable all of this somehow, right? So there is a problem is there. You cannot say there is no problem. There is a problem, right? Then corporates also tend to have a certain time for approvals and a certain way to micromanage, to disempower staff, making decisions and so on. So all of these things together again then create an atmosphere of a bit hierarchy, not only in Asia, actually. I have seen the same in the US and also in Europe. In effect, what my belief is, one of the reasons why Europe is really not catching on, specifically like Germany, my home country, and some other markets, they're really not catching on startup culture and digitization, not sufficiently. And part of that is obviously also culture. So for me, then, if you say, hey, Kit, could we then open a company, give them Macs and or whatever Linux or whatever they want to use on their laptop? Can we then be a bit more flexible with the job titles, also maybe different tools they can use, which a lot of companies by now use, like Jira and so on. It's so much faster if you do that into a combined entity than if you integrate and change all the processes first in an existing organization. So for me, that's why I said the fast start would be if you have a startup. And then when I remember this, when I started at Central, we after 6 months, we already started up the first digital platform. I mean, we created a strategy, we created a team, we hired people, and then we built, also with some partners, of course. But again, it took 6 months. And then we rolled out a new digital product every 2 months. And so, I mean, it's inconceivable that big corporate would be able to do it that well without making some adjustments to organization and with some empowerment of certain team members. I want to be careful with that again, because you can always philosophically argue for and against something, right? It's very easy to find examples of, well, but you could do it this way or that. Yeah, that's sure. And again, I'm happy for people to make it work. But, you know, the experience shows us that if you, which was the central, if there is a startup, I get a KPI on delivery and I get a KPI on revenue. And the team, the total team is being managed by a certain sense of, say, new revenue this startup creates and a certain sense of urgency, then that can definitely create significant benefit faster than if you start changing the organization and teaching people. Now, that does not mean you should not do that also, right? For me, it's kind of a dual track. You do one, you do the one thing, but it doesn't mean you stop the other. You do both, actually.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd imagine where you're just looking at what would be the, you know, like typically the biggest difficulties or hurdles in trying to launch a startup within a corporation is startups and corporates almost by their definition are not exactly mutual bedfellows when it comes to the way they operate. And you know, you mentioned agility. You know, you mentioned agility before. You know, startups are generally perceived as being flatter management structures and they can make decisions quickly, which corporations by their very nature do not do. So, you know, has that been the biggest hurdle to sort of get over? How do you make these two very different ways of thinking compatible? And as you're saying, you know, it's managing the change and the expectation between people working in different ways and I don't know, is it as much of trying to get the corporate to empower people to actually make decisions that don't have to go through multiple layers of approval?
Well, I mean, it's also the whole this is definitely a key part of it, but it's also the whole approach. If you're in a traditional IT department, you would work with a business user on a set of requirements, then you would write an RFP, like a request for proposal, and they'll send it to a set of vendors, they read it, they respond. And of course, because the RFPs are not always perfect, I mean, they're not all the things you want to do. They are, let's say, you aggregate certain ideas. And then suddenly, and even though you already have like 100 pages or something, or 150 pages which you wrote, and then suddenly, of course, as a vendor, you will make sure your proposal, because you have to be pricing it correctly, you will make the assumptions to all the assumptions when you read it go to less work. So when you then sign the proposal, suddenly you have this avalanche of change requests and so on. And then you can see that this whole process cannot be done in a week or two. It must take months. And then you have actually even vendors who come and say, well, you have to run an RFP anyway. So what we wait is then. And I remember I was once at a bank and then a very big, three-letter acronym vendor came and they said, well, anyway, you have to run an RFP. Well, why do I have an RFP? Is it right at somewhere in the law that I need an RFP for this project? No, but I assumed and I said, well, but I want it now. I don't want to argue. I mean, it's like kind of obvious. In this scenario, I mean, there was only one way or one thing you got to do. And I said, well, it's kind of obvious. We just, I don't know, we upgrade or whatever it was. And then I still remember the face of the guy. He was totally, totally flabbergasted. I was like, well, what? No RFP? And so I said, so it's, even the vendors are sometimes falling into this trap of traditional, let's say, enhancements of platforms. Again, not that they couldn't be different, but that is the majority of how IT even today still works. Now, how about we find out what we want to do on the fly? Of course, we have an intent. Of course, if I If I don't have an e-commerce app, I'm going to write an e-commerce app. If I don't have a mobile banking app, of course, I want to write a mobile banking app, right? And then I'm going to build it out somewhat with new ideas later. But it doesn't, so you'd give that to a product team and they start figuring out, actually, my budget and strategy, you know, in the last show, it's very simple, right? I just look at headcount and let's say at some of the principal partners. And even actually, if I would augment the team with third-party expertise, let's say, or just capacity, either way, again, it's actually very simple. I think, okay, well, I guess for a digital wallet, I need someone who knows how to do that. I don't have them. I need to be fast, maybe in this sense. So I find a good partner to help me with that. And then they need probably 5 or 10 people, so I can kind of put that into my budget. And then as an architecture, if I have a strategy approval process somehow, I can say, okay, we use cloud, we use open source, and maybe 2 or 3 or 4 other products, and we're done, right? Actually, it's a very simple process, right? And actually, as long as I don't change the fundamentals, I never need to ask for another approval. So for me, this is the way it should be. So you can't be half pregnant. This is the point, right? You can't want to be a startup or work like a tech company and be faster, better, smarter. But at the same time, you create a avalanche of processes and steps and checks and document writing and working with old traditional vendors who also very often have legacy products they're selling. These two things don't come together. So if you can reform your organization to not have all of this nonsense, which should never have been there in the first place, actually, frankly speaking, then fine. Unlikely, fine, but fine. The more likely approach is that you're going to get in, you build a new team, you put the best person you find on top of it, who understands all of these things somehow, creates a good team, interviews and onboards a good team. And it doesn't have to be hundreds of people. I mean, we're talking here about a team which could be, I don't know, 20, 30 people. And then you let them, obviously with some guidance, you let them run. So the latter part, of course, you have to have a bit of leap of faith in the people you hire. But again, you want to hire smart people and then you don't have a leap of faith, then I'm not so sure how is this going to work, right? So if I hire you, for example, being the smartest guy I've met, then, you know, and I don't let you do your job because why? You were successful in Australia in what you're doing, bringing up digital products, and I hire you and I don't let you do that again. Well, would that make sense? It makes some sense.
In the interest of time, because I've realized I this is clearly something I think we could keep you talking for hours. And
sorry.
Hours on,
my bad.
No. Not, it's not a bad thing at all. To wrap up this segment and potentially bring us to the end of this session, what would be your 3 tips if you're looking to build a company culture that is ready to embrace things like crypto and metaverse or whatever the future of commerce may hold?
Yeah, that's a good question also. I would say is, first of all, there has to be trust, right? This is critical, right? So even if you are, let's say, you're a bit older company, maybe even a bit bigger, but whoever is like the top team of this new unit, there has to be trust, relationship, an open relationship, and no fear environment, right? And for me, this is kind of the first most critical step, right? Because if you are behaving with the key people as one team, all the problems can be solved. So this is number one. The second one really then is that, you know, you create a free space, an open opportunity for people to experiment, but also at the same time work very hard at the goals which the team sets out. Right. So you need to do both. You need to have an ability to experiment a bit, but you also need to give people some freedom to A, create the environment, but also work on content. Right? This is probably the second step. And then the third one is don't be disheartened by setbacks, but take it as a learning and accelerate. In most times, it's not black and white. It's not like totally unsuccessful or totally successful. You've got to be somewhere in the middle, right? And but then it does not mean you're going to go out and start blaming and so on. But again, you go back to the other two and say, okay, so what is the next step? Who has to, in a fair game, who has to do what better? What do you think? And everybody can have it. So as long as you keep it constructive and professional, then you can quickly evolve and adjust yourself. And that is what gets you successful. And that if you look at the startups, they are not winning because they have the best team and they have massage chairs everywhere and they're doing parties every other day, maybe some do. But that's not actually why. They're winning because they're working well together. In almost all cases, exceptions prove the standard, I guess. So it's just kind of working towards that success, adjusting fast, and having that that ability to learn. Now, I think in such an environment, you will see that any generation, any people with any background, also diversity is extremely important. Then they can be successful, and they should.
Awesome. That is, you know, and I think on that note, we might leave it there, Axel. I really want to thank you for coming on today. That there's been so much amazing insight into the way that you personally work. And if there's anything particularly that you want to plug now, if people want to get in touch with you, you know, through social media or through your own blog or anything else, this is your chance to put something forward.
Well, I mean, of course, anybody who wants to reach out and have a chat as time permits, feel free. LinkedIn, I think for the people in the region or outside of Thailand, LinkedIn, and then other people in Thailand or Facebook maybe, then it's also fine. And also my website, axelwinter.com, one word, that also works. You can drop me a note there as per practice.
With that, there's a lot to unpack in there. Look out for us. We will put together a blog post on the Smart OSC website to summarize a lot of the amazing commentary that Axel has given us this afternoon. Thank you very much for listening. Please do make sure to subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on. Please rate and review the episode. Share it with anyone else who you think may find it interesting. And with that, we will leave everyone to it. Thanks again to Axel, and we'll see you again next time. Take care.